Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Missouri's Chief Justice sings the praises of special courts, and the city circuit attorney thinks yet another one might be a good idea. A St. Louis Circuit Court judge is being judged by the state Supreme Court, and if you're a woman who is overweight and charged with a crime, you might want to lose a few pounds before the trial. This story gives the scales of justice a whole new meaning. I'm Don Marsh. With me to talk about these and other legal issues are attorneys Mark Smith, Assistant Vice Chancellor at Washington University. He directs the Career Center there. Bill Freivogel directs the SIU Journalism School in Carbondale. And St. Louis Circuit Attorney Jennifer Joyce also joins us in studio. Jennifer, welcome back. Nice to see you again.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Mark, I'll start with you with the Circuit Court Judge Barbara Peebles case. She is suspended and has been for some months for poor supervision charges.
Right.
Bring us up to speed on where that stands now. Her case has gone before the Supreme Court in Missouri.
Exactly. So the Commission on Judicial, Discipline, recommended her removal from the bench for a variety of things. Some of the things that have been in the paper before, she had a clerk who was hearing or alleged to have been doing things a judge should have done. She was late. I think some of the biggest things was she removed a piece of paper from a file, and it was an official part of the file and shouldn't have been removed. So she went before the Supreme Court kind of appealing this decision. Ronnie White, who's a former member of the Missouri Supreme Court, was her lawyer. And basically they argued, well, yes, she made some mistakes, she did some bad things, but she shouldn't be removed. And so the Supreme Court will probably make a decision within the next couple of months. I mean, we haven't had this happen in quite some time, so I think it's hard to predict. If I were going to bet, I would bet the Supreme Court would go along with the recommendation because it's a safe thing to do. And, I mean, you know, taking something out of a file, that's a pretty big deal.
You're saying that have her permanently removed from the bench would be the – I wonder, does someone like Judge Peebles have a better chance before the Supreme Court when a former Supreme Court justice is defending her?
I don't think it hurts, but I don't – I mean, he's a good lawyer and he's well-respected, so – but I don't think there'll be any kind of special – you know, treatment because of that.
Mm. Just very quickly from the other panelists, do you agree with the probability that she's going to be permanently removed?
I don't know. I don't think I'd want to make a prediction. I think it's possible, maybe even likely.
Well, I also won't make a prediction, and for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is that my staff were witnesses in this original hearing. But I do want to say there's a lot of discussion about Judge Peebles and her actions as, you know, recently as portrayed in the Post-Dispatch. I actually, you know, we haven't spoken in many, many years, but we were colleagues together over a decade ago in the circuit attorney's office. And I actually, everybody moved through the office with a lockstep seniority kind of back then. So I was right behind her and I inherited all her files and all her cases for many years. And she was an excellent lawyer was appointed to the bench at a time when, she was above reproach. So there's not a lot of discussion about that. So I wanted to mention that as well. I don't know what that plays into the decision the Supreme Court's going to make or the issues that she's facing today. But back when we worked together, she was a very good lawyer.
Yeah. Well, as they say in broadcasting, stay tuned.
And I don't think anyone's saying she's a terrible judge. I just think they're saying she made some bad choices. But we're holding judges at such a high level. I mean, because they are such an important part of the system, we can't let that kind of stuff slide. So.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on to the next subject we have on the list here. And Bill Freivogel, I'll turn this one to you. The Missouri Court of Appeals has put a stay on the county ordinance involving foreclosure mediation. Why is that? What's going on here?
Well, so it was Judge Robert Clayton on the Court of Appeals said that St. Louis County could not enforce this foreclosure ordinance, which it passed last year and which makes things easier for those facing foreclosure. If you're facing under the law, if it ever does go into effect, you have to – the person facing foreclosure is notified that they can go to arbitration. The arbitration costs have to be paid by the bank. So the Bankers Association and I believe the Realtors also are opposed to the law, have gone to court and said, well, first of all, it's the state that regulates banks, and you can't let the local jurisdictions like St. Louis County or St. Louis City get involved in doing that. And also, I think they also make a claim that that this is taking an unconstitutional taking of property. I mean, the banks are basically not being permitted to go forward and enforce their contracts, and they're having to pay for the arbitration. It was upheld.
Isn't it a mediation?
I believe it's an arbitration.
No, I thought it was a mediation because
they're different. I know.
Yeah,
that.
They are.
How are they different?
Well, mediation and arbitration is Bill and I want to go to the movies, and we can't decide. We let Jennifer decide. Whatever she decides, we're bound by. But mediation. We can't decide about what movie we're going to go to. Jennifer comes in to help us and negotiate. Well, you know, this is not – and this is getting an Academy Award. And then – but we still ultimately have to reach agreement. And so I thought this one was – they'd have to go through the mediation process. But like you said, the banks are going to have to bear the cost, which would be expensive, and it'll slow down the process.
Yeah, I just double checked. I think you're right. It's a mediation rather than an arbitration. So it was upheld. The law was upheld by Brenda Lofton in a decision last year. It had a line in it which I just I just know you would not see a higher court ever agree with, which basically said that the individual rights, property, and rights of people had to be subservient to the greater good. That's not something you're going to get a Justice Scalia to ever agree on.
Yeah. I'm still trying to get over the visual of you two guys going to the movies together.
I can see us doing that.
I recommend Lincoln, by the way.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I think we probably all would. This, therefore, has national implications, basically, what you've just suggested, which is what
well,
we're being
yeah,
told.
It could. I mean, it's, I think a committee of the St. Louis Board of Aldermen had passed a similar bill. This month, I believe. And there are some other states that have similar legislation. Now, what I don't know, like Nevada, I believe, is one. I don't know if that was passed by the state or a local jurisdiction, which would make a difference. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Jennifer Joyce, I'm so glad you're here with us today because one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is gun violence, which I know has been very much on your mind and is certainly part of the national discussion these days. Needless to say, we don't have to go into all of that. But you say the your number one crime-fighting goal is to curb gun violence, and I've seen some chatter about a separate court for gun violence cases. Tell us a little bit about what that would involve.
Yes. You know, gun violence is a concern for me, even though I know recently there was some discussion about how crime rates have gone down in the city. And I don't pay a lot of attention to statistical data dealing with crime because there's just too much of it. And it doesn't matter to me if we're up 5% or down 6% or whatever. We have too much gun violence in the city of St. Louis. We have too many young people that are losing their lives due to gun violence. And there's a growing number of people in the criminal justice system that really feel that the time is now to take a fresh look at how the system handles gun violence cases. And many of us have been meeting, you know, we meet regularly. This topic has been under discussion for the better part of last year. And what we would like to do, and it right now the status of it is that the judges have to decide that they want to do it too, but we would like to see a separate kind of docket for armed offenders. Two types of cases. Number one, the young offenders who are caught with a gun who may not have an extensive criminal history but are clearly getting on that path. In the hopes that this court can intersect with the path that they're on and change it. And then two, armed robbery offenders, people who point a gun at someone and take their property. That is one of the most serious crimes that we face in St. Louis. I believe that it's way out of control, even though statistically it's down. And people that do that and aren't held accountable properly you know, continue to go out and rob more people, and it escalates from there possibly to a shooting or a homicide like we saw with, you know, some tragic cases last year.
What has to happen for this to happen, that is, the separate court?
Well, rightfully, the judges are in charge of stewardship of the resources of their circuit. So they have to decide that they want to commit the resources to do this. We have other stakeholders in the criminal justice system who have pledged resources. What this would look like is two judges would handle from the get-go, from the time the cases are issued, all the gun possession and armed robbery cases. They would go to these two judges, and they would handle it through every stage of the proceeding. And if that individual is placed on probation, there would be a special enhanced probation docket from probation and parole. Or if they're released on bond, there would be special supervision while they were out on bond. And so that one judge would stay in touch with that case. It wouldn't go from judge to judge. The goals of that would be, it would, you know, show the city an urgency on the part of the system, the recognition that this gun violence is unacceptable, and it's special. We're going to treat it specially. It would provide consistency. Right now we have many judges who handle these types of cases, and the outcomes vary widely from different judges to different judges. And it would provide transparency. One of the parts of this idea that I like the best is Professor Rosenfeld from UMSL has pledged resources to study this. You know, it will be very easy to study because it's only in two courtrooms, and to provide recommendations and to determine what sentencing strategies are working with different populations and what are not, and we can adjust ourselves accordingly and be more effective.
He's the right guy to be looking at it, I think. He was a guest on this program last week and often is, and he's very, very sharp in analyzing these kinds of data. There seems to be sort of a trend in this, and Judge Teitelman of the Missouri Supreme Court alluded to this in his State of the Judiciary address last week, a growing appetite for these specialized courts, thanks to Judge Price, who also has been here, with regard to veterans courts and drug courts. This seems to be a trend. Is that going too far?
I think it makes sense. It's, you know, justice is not one size fits all. It's not cookie cutter. And to the extent that you can handle cases in a customized way, I think it makes sense.
And we've had specialized courts from the beginning, bankruptcy courts or specialized courts, probate and family courts. I hadn't heard of this idea of the gun court, but that makes a lot of sense. And it sounds like, and to kind of send a message that if you use a gun, this is a big deal, and we're going to take a really hard look at it.
And you're up on the radar screen,
right?
You know, this one judge is you're not going to get the benefit of
having somebody, a different judge who didn't know you did this before,
And this is I would think the perfect time to be recommending something like that, given the national dialogue. Have to take a break already. We'll do that now. We'll continue our legal roundtable discussion when we come back. My guests in studio are St. Louis Circuit Attorney Jennifer Joyce, Bill Freivogel of SIU in Carbondale, and Mark Smith from Washington University, attorneys all. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our legal roundtable discussion. We were talking about a proposal for separate courts for gun violence cases here in St. Louis. I'll ask any of you who wants to weigh in on this with regard to all the discussion going on and all the proposals that we've been hearing about gun control or taming this problem that we have. The president has come out with some ideas. A New York newspaper has proposed publishing the names of gun owners. Thoughts about this? Bill, let me start with you. What strikes you in this discussion?
Well, it's interesting that the Missouri legislature seems to be headed in a different direction. There's a bill in the legislature to make it a crime to enforce a federal law passed after January 1st that would restrict assault rifles or big magazines. The Missouri legislature seems to have a great deal of difficulty with the supremacy clause in the Constitution, which says they can't do that kind of thing. There's also another proposal to enable educators to carry guns, teachers and teachers and principals. This is in Illinois where I teach. But it's interesting. In Illinois, Senator Kirk is trying to put together He's always been against – he's a Republican, and he's been against assault rifles. And he's trying to put together a bipartisan legislation in the Senate. So I think that is an interesting development.
We also have the proposal in Missouri to force, I think, gun owners to tell school officials if they own a gun. I don't think that's probably going to go anywhere. But coming back to what Bill said, because he was very nice about it, I mean, this proposal that Missouri is not going to follow federal law, it's ridiculous. And it's just that's political posturing. It would never work as a matter of law because federal law is supreme. And so, you know, you've got all these real problems, and then these goofball things come up for political purposes. It's just very discouraging.
Okay. What about the publishing the names of gun owners, as a New York newspaper has proposed doing? There is a right to privacy, I believe, stipulated in the Constitution.
Well, actually, the word privacy isn't in the Constitution. but there was a newspaper in New York State which published the names of people who had guns, had gun permits. There was a big reaction to that. People did feel as though their privacy was being violated, and that they were sort of like being treated like, you know, sexual predators whose identity and address is sometimes put out there. So as a journalist, I guess I feel as though that while a newspaper certainly has a right to publish any kind of public information, which this was in New York State, I don't really think it's a great idea.
Mm-hmm. I don't see the point of it. I don't know how that advances the public interest at all. It's kind of almost like sometimes when I look at the paper and they're running online everybody's salary again, you know, that they do regularly. You know, I wonder, is it just a slow news day, or somebody called in sick, and and we've got to put something up there, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, information is not necessarily beneficial to people.
Okay, well, let's leave that one. Anything else with regard to the gun issue before we move on? I don't see any hands raised, so let's do so. A couple of things going on in the city and the state that are worth mentioning, at least. One is the proposal to decriminalize marijuana in the city. And the other thing I wanted to take a quick look at was the probability of at least an attempt to revise the criminal code in Jefferson County or in Jefferson City. Jennifer, let me turn to you with regard to the decriminalization issue. How do you look at that?
Well, I have to say that it doesn't decriminalize marijuana. You know, that seems to be a shorthand that people are using, but marijuana is still a crime under federal and state laws. Basically, this has the potential to be a very common sense type of thing. I was talking to Shane Cohen, the alderman who proposed this, and he's very thoughtful about how he's approaching this. I have always said there's some cases that make a lot more sense being held at the city court level, and there's some cases that make more sense at state court, and there's some cases that make more sense at federal court. And as I see this, this gives the police the option of taking these marijuana cases to city court, where they can be handled in a much more cost-efficient way than to take them to state court. And I think that makes sense depending on the case. And so where I see this coming down is in the police department, they're going to have proper procedures and protocol so that the officer on the street knows that, hey, this guy's got priors, I'm going to take him to state court to be prosecuted, or this guy has no priors, he's going to city court to be prosecuted.
Chief Dotson was in the other, excuse me, Mark. Yeah. Chief Dotson was here the other day, and he said, that works, but there have to be consequences.
Well, they get a summons.
Mm-hmm.
And
they pay a fine.
And I think there's still possibility of up to 90 days in jail. It sounds like that might not happen. Maybe I'm not sure. But it seems like we've got limited police resources. And, you know, personally, I'd rather have the police resources focused on the gun crimes that Jennifer was talking about rather than some, 22-year-old who's getting high.
The fact is it's a lot quicker for the police to charge someone with a city crime than it is a state crime. Yeah. State crime takes several hours of their time.
Yeah, they got to take them down. I mean, that's a big production.
It's a warrant application. In city court, you write them a summons. Hmm. There's also fine revenue generated for the city through the city court process, and there's no revenue generated for the city through state court prosecution. Alderman Cohn has told me that the idea is that this revenue will be used at least in some part for drug treatment, prevention, outreach, things like that. So that makes sense, too.
So it's treating it more like a health problem.
Yes.
Slash criminal problem.
But only first offenders,
right.
I hope. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what I'd like to see. We figure about 200, 300 cases we prosecuted last year would make more sense in city court, marijuana cases, and we'll see what they actually do.
The other issue is the potential for revising the criminal code in Jefferson City. Anything in particular, Jennifer Joyce, that you'd like to see there?
Yeah, we were talking about this a little bit in the green room, and you know, I don't know if people realize what a miraculous thing this proposed legislation is, because it was 4 years in the making. It was a bar committee that had equal amounts of defense attorneys and prosecutors, and they went through one by one and looked at all the areas of the Missouri statutes where there was a crime, and you know, that what they came out with was something that I think is a vast improvement as a package over what we have now. And, you know, I have trouble imagining this group agreeing that the sky is blue, but they came out with this complex system of proposed changes, which greatly improved the criminal code. Prosecutors support it as a package. If people start hacking away at it and saying they like this part and not this part, I think they run the risk of this whole thing collapsing, because it works as a package. Everybody gave a little bit. Everybody got a little bit.
Is there anything in particular you could point to that as an example of what you think would be particularly effective?
Well, I think that on the whole, the emphasis of this criminal code proposal emphasizes incarceration for violent crime, mm-hmm. and gives options for other than incarceration for nonviolent crime. There's an additional fifth felony class that's created by this legislation. There's a fourth misdemeanor class that's created, and this allows the system, you know, the prosecutors and the judges and the people that determine sentencing, to have much more range as to what they can sentence somebody to. And it updates the language. It's modernized. It's more cohesive. And it'll just be easier for people to know, hey, what's a crime and what isn't a crime.
It updates all the fines and makes them consistent.
Right.
The last time this was done, John Danforth was Missouri Attorney General. So you can,
yes.
That was a while ago,
yeah.
I think 77 or something.
Well, and the fines, I mean, criminals have been getting a really good deal here, because
yeah.
the fines have not been adjusted for inflation since 1970. So I don't know what else you can buy that hasn't been adjusted since 1970.
Well, any other thoughts on this, or shall we? But let's move along.
It's a good idea, too.
The U.S. Supreme Court has got an issue, Bill Freivogel, we have talked about before, this warrantless blood test, the DUI case. Where does that stand at the present time? Is it really much different than what we've talked about before?
Well, it is a little different. I mean, I think that a lot of people thought that when the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to hear this case, that they were probably going to disagree with the Missouri Supreme Court. The Missouri Supreme Court said there had to be a warrant under these circumstances. What happened was there was a motorist driving after midnight erratically in southeast Missouri, stopped by a trooper. A trooper had read that he no longer needed to get a search warrant in a situation like this to get a blood test. The motorist had refused to take a breathalyzer. And so took him to the hospital, and they forcibly took a blood test. So the question is that a search? And do you need to have a warrant, as the Fourth Amendment generally requires? I think during the oral arguments, it seemed as though quite a number of the justices, including Justice Scalia, from sometimes the more conservative but libertarian side, seemed to not be in particular sympathy with the extent to which the Missouri prosecutors wanted to take this. And they seem to think that a blood test of this sort might be would be a search and would require a warrant where a warrant could be obtained. The argument of the Missouri prosecutors was, well, the evidence in a person who's drunk is constantly being destroyed, you know, as time passes.
By time, yeah.
I guess about in the 1960s, the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court had said that in a situation where there's a drunk driver and they refuse to have a test and say there's a traffic accident, so sort of a complication involved in the arrest, that then you did not need a warrant. Now, this is a situation – so the question is, in a situation where there's not that kind of complication of a traffic accident that delays everything, where you're right away able to take the person right to a hospital, shouldn't the trooper be required to get a warrant? So it sort of looks like the Supreme Court may actually hold that way, but it's dangerous to predict Supreme Court decisions.
One of the facts was this guy was handcuffed in the hospital while they took blood, and there was a lot of – there seemed to be a lot of concern about that and not buying into this idea that there was real harm by waiting to get a warrant.
Hey, here's how you avoid all that.
Don't drink and drive.
Submit to the breathalyzer, okay?
Yeah.
You know, when the police ask you to blow. That way you don't find yourself handcuffed to a gurney with someone taking your blood.
But this guy was apparently 1.5 or something, and drunk, I guess, is 1.08. So he knew if he blew.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's the problem here, is that under Missouri law, the implied consent, people refuse a breathalyzer. They're supposed to have a year, lose their license for a year. In reality, I can guarantee you that does not happen. There's all kinds of exceptions to that. And so what I see is people who refuse over and over and over and over again. If you're a criminal defense attorney, you're negligent if you don't give your client that advice, because it's a way to escape being held accountable for driving drunk. And, you know, I think the frustration that prosecutors have is this is very similar to the drug bust, where, you know, you don't expect the police to politely knock at the door. Hello, the police, we're here. While you hear the toilets flushing everywhere.
Right.
You know, this is the same kind of thing. This person knows they're drunk. That's why they're refusing. And their body is metabolizing the alcohol. And sometimes you can get a warrant quickly and sometimes you can't.
So what would be the time, like in the city of St. Louis, to get a warrant?
Well,
are you talking an hour or are you talking 4 hours?
I would like to see that you could get it in under 2 hours, but that does not always happen.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly in bigger cities, it kind of depends on who's on duty and how, you know. Some prosecutors have used like public safety grant money to buy iPads for various responders to kind of speed up the process, and they actually do drills, you know, because this will happen at 3 a.m.
Right.
Which, you know, I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer at 3 a.m. when my phone rings. So, but I think we can speed up the warrant process, but sometimes, you know, it's just not possible to do it quickly enough. And we find people that are eluding responsibility for repeated drunk driving because of this loophole in Missouri law. And the prosecutors are proposing legislation that would make refusing to blow actually tampering with physical evidence part of that crime. And so it would be a separate crime in and of itself to refuse. So, I mean, I hate to sound bloodthirsty, but I'm actually...
You're the prosecutor. You're supposed to be, yeah.
That's right.
There's one other issue several I want to get to, but one in particular I wanted to get some input from you folks on, and that's the weight bias in the courtroom. I think we're all familiar with the fact that Yale research has shown that stigma of being overweight extends to the courtroom. Heavy people more likely to be convicted, according to this study. Interestingly, men are more likely to assign guilt to overweight females, but not to overweight males. Women, on the other hand, did not discriminate against overweight male or female defendants. What about this notion of a bias at all? Anyone have any thoughts with regard to that?
Well, one interesting local angle to this is I think this was research done by St. Louis and Natasha Chavez. And it basically seems to say that male jurors, I think this was a mock court, so it wasn't actually a real case, but the male jurors are more likely to convict sort of heavy women.
And this was for like check fraud or something. And so there was a suggestion in it that maybe if it was like bank robbery, there wouldn't be that bias because they would think, well, they're not active enough to rob a bank or something. So there seemed to be a lot of speculation in this. I don't know. Plus, it was the Center for Food Policy and Obesity. I don't know, Food Policy Center. This is why people make fun of higher education sometimes. But still interesting, I think, and obviously something you want to be aware of. But I don't know that I would be jumping. This is one study. I don't know that it's...
But Jennifer Joyce, appearances do seem to matter. We talked off the air earlier about, you know, some defendants get cleaned up pretty well before appearing before the judge, so they won't look the part that they're being charged with.
Sure, absolutely. They get cleaned up. The public defender's office has a row of suit jackets and things and ties, and they look remarkably different from their mugshot the night they were arrested after committing their crime. As far as this study goes, I guess my issue with it is criminal cases are like snowflakes. It's impossible to compare one to the other. You know, there's so many variables. It could be that the one defendant made more eye contact with the jury. It could be, you know, the one defendant had an obnoxious lawyer who everybody hated. You know, there's just too many variables to say that jurors are making up their mind based on the weight of the defendant. And I've seen many skinny people go to prison.
So you're thumbs down to the results of this study. Is that the bottom line?
Well, now I feel bad because it's from a St. Louis person.
Yeah, me too. I
thought it was an interesting study. I'll say that. It was interesting.
I thought what was very interesting, according to the study, was the way that men and women reacted differently to this.
Yeah, that just, I think that, says
this
the
is
most.
Opening up a whole different ballgame right here.
Men are bad and women are good. That's what we learned from it.
Before we get too heavily into that, let's take another break. We'll do that and continue with our legal roundtable discussion. We have other things to talk about, but I'd like to get the listening audience into this discussion as well with things that we've talked about so far. 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stopublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. You can also reach us through Facebook. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our legal roundtable discussion. My guests in studio, St. Louis City Circuit Attorney Jennifer Joyce, Bill Freivogel from SIU in Carbondale, and Mark Smith from Washington University. We've dealt with the weight bias in the courtroom or the lack thereof. Where can we go from here? One of the things that, again, Jennifer Joyce has been, I'm so glad you're here with us this time, and that's the case of George Allen. 30 years in prison for a crime he apparently did not commit, rape and murder. He was released within the last couple of weeks. You decided to dismiss any charges against Mr. Allen.
Yes.
What was the rationale behind that decision?
Well, George Allen, many people believe he's guilty. Many people believe he's not guilty. I really don't know whether he's guilty or not. He was not exonerated of the crime, but what the court found in his habeas proceeding was that he did not receive a fair trial. And I agree with that. He did not receive a fair trial. I consider the George Allen case to be a colossal failure on the part of the justice system. Both the victim and George Allen were failed in that case.
By whom?
By the system in general. The two things that really, there was a lot of discussion about how the interrogation of Mr. Allen was done improperly and things of that nature. But what the court really hung its hat on was that there were documents that the police department had that they never gave to the prosecutor in that case. And so the prosecutor, in turn, could not give them to the defense counsel. And because they didn't have that information, he did not receive a fair trial. And I completely agree with that. And and I am troubled by it, even though it occurred 30 years ago. I think that this is an opportunity for all of us to sit down and look at the procedures and policies in the police department and find a way to make sure that this kind of oversight doesn't happen again.
Has there been any overture to getting some sort of a group together to do just that?
Yes, actually. I've been in contact with national officials and people like Barry Scheck and the head of the police chiefs of major cities. I've gotten their information as to how this has been done in other cities successfully. In the past, I have talked to Chief Isom about it, and I think that he was, I don't want to say he was unenthusiastic about it. I think he realized I think it was a little daunted by the idea of that task. But Chief Dotson is very interested in working on this. Members of the police board are, and I think we're going to be sitting down to begin studying this issue and making some clear recommendations and holding people accountable for following them.
Yeah. Meantime, if my memory serves me correctly, Attorney General Koster is still in the game here, or is that not the case?
No, he appealed the ruling that overturned the conviction, and then that the ruling overturning the conviction was upheld. And so he declined to further appeal.
Oh, I missed that entirely.
So your office's dismissal was the final of the indictment. That was the final step.
Right. And I dismissed the case for a couple of reasons. Number one, we have key witnesses that are dead now.
Right. There's like, like you said, 30 years ago.
Right. The detective who did the initial interview, I've got lots of questions for him. He's dead. He's been dead a long time. And the other thing is I do not charge people with crime unless I am convinced that they committed it. And, you know, there's all this confusion about the presumption of innocence. Prosecutors don't have the presumption of innocence. If I've charged you with a crime, it's because I believe you committed the crime. You know, that's the system that has the presumption of it, the jury. I'm not sure at this point what happened in this case. And it's very troubling to me, even though it happened before I came to the office. And I want to make sure it doesn't happen again.
30 years. We were all in knee pants when all this was happening.
This murder occurred during that big. Remember the big snowstorm of '82.
Yeah. Yes.
That's when it was. How long ago was that? I was in college.
It's a terrible murder. I mean, terrible.
Is there any indication that the lab technician who was implicated here for not turning over the report that happened in it? That happened in any other cases?
No, and I don't think at all that this was an intentional, we're going to try and affect the outcome of this prosecution. I think that this is left-hand, right-hand issues. And the police department, as Mark Smith well knows, is a giant organization with many different, the detectives generate notes out on the street, the patrolman, the lab generates notes. You know, there's all these different things going on, and I'm not satisfied that there's a comprehensive system for getting all of those into one spot and getting all of those turned over to the prosecutor. And I don't think that anybody had any ill will. I think this is a system and process issue that's a hard one, but it's a system and process issue that needs to be addressed.
Let's go to the listening audience and get members of that audience into the conversation. We'll start with Tim, who is calling from St. Louis. Tim, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. You know what? Fascinating discussion today. I just wanted to call in and let you know the discussion about bias in juries is what triggered my call. I have the coolest job in all of law. I run focus groups for attorneys, and we have a system where we don't even allow the attorneys in the room so that you can get a real unfiltered perspective from people who are examining a case. And as the discussions went on, I was interested in finding out everybody's perspective on the value of examining all of these things objectively in advance before the case is actually going to the courtroom. We work in both civil and we haven't touched much on criminal, but we seem to be getting a lot of attention in that area lately, a lot of requests for the reason of examining things that could conceivably diffuse bias as the case goes into the courtroom. And I was wondering everybody's thoughts on that.
All righty, Tim, thanks for the call. Who would like to
I only tried a few cases, and it's a long time ago, but, you know, we represented defendants. So we liked jurors who were upper-level managers because we thought they were going to be more favorable to our big corporate clients, and we didn't like people who had had problems. I mean, that was kind of – and we were looking for ways to get them off the jury. But you don't have a whole lot of ability – the Supreme Court's kind of restricted your ability to strike people. So we would take our strikes and try and, you know, use it. But it's an inexact science at best. What do you – you're trying the most cases.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. I've read books on the topic of, you know, jury selection and jury consulting. O.J. Simpson is a fantastic example. They had a great jury consultant in that case. I guess the lawyers in my office, they try enough cases every other week. They're picking a jury. They become they develop a good sense. But I'm always open to having additional insight into what type of juror we would want on a particular case. And if the caller is interested in doing any pro bono work, please call me, because we certainly don't have any money in the budget for that as a private law firm would, but I'm always interested in other people's perspective on that.
But the voir dire process is much more restricted from being on a jury in criminal cases or being on the panel, never got picked. And then it's not like in the movies where you know the lawyers are having these long conversations with all the people, the judges.
It can be. In
really?
State court, it can be. In federal court, the judges do a lot of
they
the questioning and they rein it in. But in state court, it really depends on the judge.
Oh, see, I guess it's the judges they've been restricting it too.
Mm-hmm. I think it's important to get jurors who stay awake. I've covered trials where the jurors are falling asleep, including the one on the Waco David Koresh trial. That had a small secret jury, and a number of them were dozing off.
Well, I've got news for you. I've been to a trial here in St. Louis that was much celebrated, in which the judge fell asleep.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've seen that too, right?
Right.
Judge was just resting eyes. Right?
I will not divulge the name, but that certainly was the case. Let's bring in Dan, calling from South St. Louis. Go ahead, Dan.
Hi, I have a question for Ms. Joyce. Are you aware of the frustrations of St. Louis City police officers who bring cases to your office involving gun violence and are denied and you guys don't pick up the case, and they have to go shop it around the federal court. And sometimes the feds don't even pick them up. Or when the feds do pick them up, they can't get a prosecution. What is your criteria for saying, yeah, we'll take this case? No, we won't. And how many of the cases that you did not get picked up in federal court due to officers shopping them over there, not you sending them over yourself?
Well, I had a little trouble hearing you there because you're on a car phone, but I think your question was, what is our criteria for issuing a gun possession case? And it's the same as for prosecuting any case. Do we believe that there was a crime committed, and do we have evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the individual charged is the one who committed the crime? And that's our analysis in its basic form, from everything from capital murder to possession of misdemeanor marijuana. Some gun cases do go over to the federal prosecutors. They don't come to us. I don't have any way of tracking how many there are. I assume that the officers that would take a case to federal court would have a reason to do that. And candidly, we have so many cases in our circuit that, you know, I know some prosecutors get their nose out of joint when cases go to federal court. I'm always like, here, take this one, too. You know, we are not hurting for business, and the federal prosecutors do an excellent job, too.
Thanks very much for your call. Let's bring in Karen calling from St. Louis. Karen, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I guess I just wanted to comment on the whole bias thing, as well as what you were talking about with the drug driving stuff. I'm in my early 30s, and about 10 years ago, I was, you know, mistakenly pulled over for drunk driving. Not mistakenly, I was, but there was no traffic accident or anything involved. And I guess I just felt, I failed every field test, but I felt like because I was a young, attractive, dressed up female that they let me off, and they had me call a friend and had my friend come get me. But I just felt like, while I was glad that I wasn't taken up on any charges or anything, I felt after the fact like that was kind of wrong, in that if I had been, you know, a male, or if I had been an overweight female, or even if I had just been in sweatpants and, you know, a sweatshirt, that I would have been taken up on charges. And I guess I just wanted to hear what you guys thought about, you know, bias with regards to drunk driving stops.
Hmm.
The silence is deafening.
I don't know. I mean, I've been stopped once by a police officer. Did the pass the test? Although I got to tell you, I'm not the most coordinated guy. I hadn't had anything to drink. I was out late, and for some reason they thought. But I guess because I'm a bad driver. I think police officers have a great deal of discretion. And is it always used correctly? Maybe not. But
so you didn't get off because of your good looks?
I was going to say.
As we've said before, I have a face made for radio. So, no, I don't think it was my term in good looks.
I will say this. I believe that I can totally see what the caller says.
Yeah.
It depends on, police officers are individuals. You hope that that doesn't happen a lot, but I couldn't say that it doesn't. I had an aunt who was a nun, and she would drive around in a habit and, dress like a nun. And she was the worst driver I have ever seen. Terrible. And she would get pulled over a lot for like weaving and stuff like that. She wasn't drunk. She's just a terrible driver. And she never got a ticket because the officer would walk up and see that she was a nun, and he'd just say, "Be careful, sister." And, how you present yourself to the officer, good, bad, or otherwise, makes a difference,
but
I think.
This brings us back to that whole appearance thing again. I mean, mm-hmm. that does play a role in cases like this and others.
It does.
All right.
It shouldn't, but it does.
It's not just appearance. It's, I think, the way you act. Because some people are very belligerent. And,
yes.
And then it's like, you're definitely getting in trouble. But other people, I can call my friend just, and beg a little bit.
Chris Rock has a wonderful piece of business out there on YouTube that folks might want to take a look at with regard to how to respond to a police officer. It is really good. Let's bring in another caller. Alex in St. Louis. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I have something I wanted to bring up here. I read an article recently on the web. It was in the Huffington Post in the business section about a company called Corrections Corporation of America. And they were saying this company was a Wall Street giant, and there was a 6-page article in the business section about how much money they're making and how they operate in 48 states. But one thing it briefly mentioned in there, which I thought was basically criminal, it was saying that, when they come into these states and buy these prisons and take over, and kind of like outsource the work where they were taking over to save states money, that they were asking the states, and the states were agreeing to this, to sign a 20-year contract guaranteeing that the prison will remain 90% full, a minimum of 90% full the whole time for 20 years. So, when you read this kind of thing, you can't help but assume that they want people in jail. And I was kind of going over this because I know someone, who's in that little jail out there in Clayton now, and they know that there's video cameras everywhere. They accused him of something. They've got a video of him in a department store at the time this alarm went off. And every time they take him up for trial, they just do a continuance and just keep him and keep him and keep him. And they won't, release him or have a trial to see exactly, and they know they have the video that's showing that he didn't do it.
Alex, let me stop you there because time's getting away and see if we can get a response. Anyone like to take that up? They want people in prison?
Well, I think there have been a lot of questions. I have not read the article that the caller refers to. There have been a lot of questions raised over a number of years about private companies that provide prison services. If in fact there is that kind of provision in a contract, I understand the caller's criticism.
Well, they have no problem keeping the prisons full. That's for certain.
No, they don't.
That's part of the problem, the discussion about revising the criminal code so that we have enough room for those who really need to be there.
Right. We need to have the people that should be in prison, the people that should be out in probation supervision out. And mm-hmm. That's an easy thing to say. It's a hard thing to do.
Exactly.
In the little over a minute that we have left, Clarence Thomas was heard actually speaking during a presentation before the Supreme Court. 1 minute left. Is too much been made of this? He was apparently telling a joke.
He was making fun of Yale Law School, which is where he went to law school. He has no love for Yale Law School. And I think he gets a bad rap. He doesn't ask questions, but I think that's his prerogative. I'm not sure that much is really learned by asking questions. So
well,
that's
what he says, that he's there to listen, not to talk.
I mean, he's read the briefs, and I think he probably knows what the issues are. So
Well, I agree with Mark. I think Clarence Thomas gets a bad rap. I disagree with a lot of what he writes, but it's not surprising to me. He's a very funny man, and it's not surprising to me that when he finally did break his silence, that it was a joke about criticizing his former law school.
Well, it was interesting the way the media hopped on that. Well,
yeah.
Like he had actually said something that was meaningful. Anyway. Okay, we've got to end it right there. I want to thank you all so much for being with us. The most informative program today. Jennifer Joyce, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Good to have you as part of this panel. Bill Freivogel, same to you. Good to see you again. And Mark Smith.
Thank you.
Nice to have you with us one more time. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll have reaction to an analysis of Missouri Governor Jay Nixon's State of the State address. You can listen to Mr. Nixon's address tonight right here on St. Louis Public Radio. Our coverage begins at 7 o'clock and will include the Republican response. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.